Without any further ado, I'll announce Garth Gibson, and he's going to scare you to death about reliability.
Okay, thank you. My name is Garth Gibson, and I'm here to scare you, and then maybe try to suggest that there's some hope. I, in this case, am representing the DOE, Office of Science, SCIDAC, Scalable Scientific Advances through Scientific Discovery through Advanced Computing, Petascale Data Storage Institute. And it's 8 institutions, 5 national labs. You see them across here. I don't know the pointer works. 3 universities. 2 of the universities are represented here, and at least 2 of the national labs are represented in the room. Broadly, our agenda is the, as you go out to top500.org and its projections, you're going to build computers of those scale over the next 10 years. You're going to get to exascale. You're going to have I.O. problems. What are they, and how should we address them, and what are the tools that need to be put into place? We probably can't solve all the problems. We solve what we can, and we make sure that everybody else that can work on the other problems is equipped with as much information as we can. So we're in the petaflop era. Gary was quite humble in referring to the fact that Los Alamos and IBM have about a couple weeks ago actually done the execution and announced it yesterday that there is a petaflop computer now, and it is going to be working at Los Alamos Labs as soon as the trucks get there. Right. That means we've got 10 years to exascale. That's what it means. So with respect to failure data, what I want to do as a storage person, one of the driving characteristics in storage workloads for the largest computers is part of the fault-tolerance scheme. So let's understand what's going to happen in the fault-tolerance scheme. So we take the data that Gary was referring to releasing. Over here you've got this nice big table of 9 years of all the clusters at Los Alamos, and all of the outages that any of the applications suffered were identified, and the root cause was assigned if possible. The very different architectures. In the bottom, you see a graph here of 22 machines, or I think it's 19 machines, and the total failures per year per processor. This is the strongest signal. That is, if I try to correlate it with OSs or nodes or clusters, the strongest signal is per processor. And it suggests that somewhere between 0.1 failures per year per processor and 0.25 failures per year per processor were suffered over a 9-year span of all of the high-end computers of all the different type of platforms. That's a pretty good signal, and suggests that barring somebody showing you really strong reasons to believe otherwise, you'd imagine that future computers, counting whatever processor is, I'm going to claim it's a chip, right, as opposed to a core, is going to see between 0.1 failures per year and 0.25 failures per year. So what happens? Well, we got top500.org scaling out there at doubling per year, and I've got Moore's Law increasing the number of cores on a chip at maybe doubling every 18 months, probably a bit slower. And I get no cycle speed from the cycle time. I get no additional speed from the cycle time. So roughly, peak-wise, I'm getting all the performance from the increase in the number of cores at doubling every 18 months or slower. Yet we know from the curves that we will build machines that are doubling every year. That means more chips. That means a lot more chips. So even if the increasing number of cores on a chip do not increase my failure rates, which is what the chip manufacturers are trying to achieve, even if you believe that that's the case, you're still going to have more chips in order to stay on the curve. The more chips is going to be a linear increase in the number of failures per year. That's what that, not linear. It's going to be an exponential increase in the number of sockets that, and then a linear multiplier for the number of failures per year, which is an exponential increase in the number of failures per year, which means that over here on the right, I'm showing you the mean time between interrupt for any job that uses them all. Right. That curve is sort of out there at 10 hours, let's say two outages a day, dropping down in 10 years when we get to exascale to every 20 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever of the Moore's Law or the rate of growth of cores you believe. So clearly this is a problem. As you might imagine, what's going to happen is we're going to get no effective use of this computer. Why? Well, because the way we do fault tolerance is we stop every once in a while, write out the state from the application, then resume, and when a failure occurs, we roll back. So we give up useful cycles to fault tolerance whenever we stop to take a checkpoint and whenever we have to roll back and recompute anything. Right? So the whole plan for the last 20 years or so has been maintain balance. When the number of cycles per second doubles, double the memory size for the computation to grow, double the I.O. bandwidth so that every checkpoint can write out the size of memory in a constant amount of time. And if the interrupt rate doesn't change, then the application utilization shown there in that equation wouldn't change. If the time to capture a checkpoint stays the same and the mean time between interrupts stays the same, then the app utilization stays the same, and you get whatever 95% effective utilization of your cycles you want. However, there are two problems with this curve. One has been the alluded to problem that we're not scaling the I.O. bandwidth to keep up with the total amount of memory and the total number of cycles, and that's for the cost reason. Paul already mentioned it. The second one is that the interrupt rate is, in fact, increasing. Yes, you can tell the vendors that you want it to be constant, but if they can't build it, they can't build it. Right? It is, in fact, increasing. The curves I've got here in the bottom right suggest that the mean time to interrupt alone, even if we can maintain balance by buying enough disks, is going to drive the utilization well below 50% effective utilization in a few years and down to zero in the time frame of... So clearly, we're not going to do that. We're spending far too much money to do that. But what we're going to have to do is spend a lot of time on the fault tolerance of the system and one or more techniques to try and fight back on the degrading amount of resources that are left over after we fight fault tolerance. So I got four ways, roughly, that we're addressing it. One is to push up the bandwidth. That is the one we're basically trying to do. Now, I have to remind everybody, disks get faster at 20% per year. Total bandwidth is supposed to go up at 100% per year. That means the total number of disks is supposed to increase at 67% per year. That's faster than the number of nodes or the number of chips are increasing. Hence Paul's comment that over time, more and more money goes into storage. And yes, if we're cycle bigots, and most of us are, that's not a very appealing thing. Okay? What's worse is if you're going to try and solve the mean time to interrupt problem with the same increased storage even more, you're going to have to increase the number of spindles by 130% per year. The cost issues are outrageous. Hence, this solution, while it works, is rather expensive. The next solution, and this is the one that actually could be done, although I don't think people will do it. If you compress the checkpoint a larger amount every year so that the fraction of main memory is decreasing every year at the same rate that the interrupt rate's going up, you can cancel the problem. You just have to make the fraction of memory that's going into the checkpoint follow that curve that's on the lower right there, which means that it collapses down to a very small fraction of the total memory which is going into the checkpoint. Now, you have the cycles because you're taking that checkpoint, you're stopping for a period of time, you've got the whole machine to work with, you got all the brains that you have and your programmers that are currently working on physics. If you just take them off the physics problem and put them on checkpoint compression, you might be able to solve this problem. However, I don't think they're going to really like that. Okay? So there's the cycle bigots and then there's the physics bigots. Neither one of them like these solutions. All right. The solution you heard from Paul is what I've got next, is dedicated checkpoint devices. Devices that try to absorb the checkpoint at an increasing rate and then dribble it to storage later on. We need to find technology that scales its performance much faster than disk per cost so that it can keep up at being a small fraction of the cost. The problem is that we don't have that technology right now. Paul's suggestion was to use disks in a different way so they're more effective. And that's a great move, and it gets us a few years. But those disks are still increasing their speed at 20% per year once you're using them at their best efficiency, and you don't get any more out of it. You have to go find another solution. Other people have talked about flash because it's sort of closer to DRAM, but at much lower cost. DRAM, of course, is going to be too expensive. Roughly 40% of the cost of the nodes is probably DRAM. So having a complete copy of that in DRAM is a 40% increase. You don't want to do that either. Flash would be cheaper. The problem is flash doesn't write very well, doesn't write very fast. And the ratio between capacity and write bandwidth in flash right now, which suggests that if you got enough bandwidth in Flash, it would cost more than the cost of the storage. So it's more expensive than Paul's solution, and it also doesn't scale because Flash has the same problem. The write bandwidth is not growing as fast as the capacity. The only solution I can put forward that might actually solve this without any scaling problem is to give up on half of your machines, replication solution, and do process pairs so that you don't actually stop any more than one node when there's a failure, process pairs. Cycle bigots amongst us aren't going to like that one, but at least it scales nicely. All right. So what I've said so far is that the rate of increase in demand for cycles, given what we have coming out of the technologists, means that we have more and more components. More and more components is more and more failures. I don't care if you write in your request for proposals that you want a constant failure rate. You're not going to get it. If you buy more components, you're going to get more failures. To solve that, your traditional solution is more bandwidth. That is not our fault. You tell us to buy a lot more components, we spend a lot more money, and you don't like that. So we can do that, but if you want other solutions, you're going to have to either put time into the state compression, find new technologies, and I know there's funding going into new technologies that might apply to checkpointing, or give up a larger fraction of your resources for new and different checkpoint strategies. This analysis is in the Journal of Physics, SciDec 2007 journal. You can read it at your will. All right. Now, that assumed that storage was perfect, right? Because, in fact, storage has failures, too. Here's some data also gathered in the same round of collection from supercomputing and, in this case, some Internet service organizations of about 100,000 disks over a month to 5 years. And what do we see? Well, we see a little more variability in the different sites and the different failure rates. We see failure rates between 1%, which is what the manufacturers would say, and about 3% per year failing. Again, you know, we can take it as linear with respect to the number of spindles. The spindles are growing at 67% per year, so we again have another exponential growth in failures in the storage subsystem. The problem for storage is we can't throw away the last hour, go back and pick it up from there. Right? We're not allowed to. Our job is to take every byte in without any loss. And in fact, as I heard earlier, there is the perception that no data will be lost at any time, at any place. Right? Now, that's very nice. That's like saying that there will be no crime or no security breaks. And I understand that there's going to be policies that state that, but it's not a very realistic thing to design to. Right? It is an unbounded cost approach. Right? What we're really going to have to do from a cost approach is talk about rates of data loss so that we can figure out what they cost and how we insure ourselves against them. It's a much more reasonable model, but we're not there yet because we can't quite get past this no loss of any kind. All right. So the storage guys over here are building systems to try and protect against loss. So what do? We have failure redundancy, failure correction schemes. RAID is the classic one. If you look at the way the RAID system works, when you lose a drive, you read the remainder of the drives in the RAID set to rebuild the lost drive. Okay? So I got an exponentially growing rate of failures, and when I do a reconstruction, I have a bounded number of drives and a bounded RAID controller that are going to read the contents of the drives, which are growing at 40 to 60% per year, exponentially bigger. So I get those two exponential factors multiplying against each other, and I get a very rapid increase in the amount of time it's going to take and the fraction of time that I'm going to be doing these reconstructions. This curve over here shows the estimated number of concurrent reconstructions that are going to be going on in the system. That is at all times. So, yeah, maybe 5%, 10% of the time. Now there's some reconstructions where there's some disk array that's taken 72 hours to repair a drive in the background. Right? But in 10 years, you're going to be talking about 100 concurrent reconstructions at all times. Right? That means the design of the storage subsystem is going to be not only lossless, but lossless and high performance while it is suffering 100 concurrent failure recoveries at the same time. The complexity of that code scares the devil out of me, right? Which is why my really long-term research has to do with formal methods for proving correctness in complex code like file systems. But in the short term, what I've got to do is figure out ways to make those reconstructions take much less time, much less work, so that we don't have as many of them going on at the same time. There are techniques that address some of it. The core problem is that the amount of work involved in the size of the drives is causing great pain. Now, you'd like to think that since the last 10 years, the drives have gotten 10 times more reliable, and the mean time to loss of data in a RAID is proportional to the square of the mean time to failure of the drive, that we've got a factor of 100 advantage in time. But in fact, we've given up far more than that in the size of the drives. The size of the drives has gone up by more than 250 times. So that term in the reliability on the bottom, mean time to repair, is overwhelming the square of the improvement in the reliability of the components. And then I got to deal with the size of the total number of drives, which is growing exponentially as well. So longer, riskier reconstructions. I got two factors in the reconstructions that are causing me grief. One is the total amount of work because of the size of the drives. And the other is that while I'm doing that work, I may suffer media failures. And media failures will take out one sector or a couple of sectors, and it's not much data, but when I take it out, it gets added as another failure. So I'm repairing one failure, I lose a sector, and I got a second failure along one strip. So I've only got one sector at risk out of the billions and billions of sectors I'm reconstructing, but that one sector forms a second failure, and I've lost everything, which is why some implementations are now offering you double correction, because double correction will fix that one sector. Right? Now, of course, it won't fix a second drive, because if two drives are out, I still got to read the rest of the array. I'm still going to get another sector loss, and I'll have three failures along one row. So I'm burning my whole double correcting code scheme to pay for the single correct failed drive and a single sector loss to a media failure. All right. So what I got to do first is I got to find a way to make reconstruction go faster in a bigger system. Now, I heard Paul mention parity declustering. Parity declustering is a scheme that says spread your RAID equations out. Use all the drives. If you use all the drives in your system and there's more drives in later systems, then there's more bandwidth in later systems, and you can get a reconstruction that scales up linearly with the size of the system rather than remaining constant. This is the kind of thing, and this may not be the only solution, but this is the kind of thing that gives you a way to fight back on the total amount of work and the amount of time you spend in reconstruction and therefore the increasing number of reconstructions. Big message I want to make here is that we have to do a lot to work on the parallelism in the algorithms in storage for its internal problems, because its failure characteristics are worse, the rate of increase in spindles is higher, and the tolerance for losing anything is much, much tougher. Right? And then for things like the media failure, I'm looking to point solutions, solutions that go more narrowly focused on the problem. Panasis, a company that I started in 1999, has a solution right now for the media failures where you add in another layer of code inside the drive to fix the media failure before it gets to the reconstruction agent, so you don't have to steal an entire double-correcting code to fix the media failure. Right? This could be done by the drive manufacturers, and it probably would be if they could capitalize in dollars. But it's not so clear that we're quite prepared to pay for an increase in dollars, especially since most of the customers of disks are not sensitive to this problem. They've got one disk in a desktop. There's no RAID going on there at all. All right, so solutions like this can focus on the actual cause of the problem and be a more efficient solution to the problem. All right. So I've talked about the reconstruction of large files. Now I want to point out, this is, maybe I didn't need to do this given all the emphasis we've put onto metadata already, but I want to point out that there's really not that many large files. There's really a huge number of really small files. This data is collected from the national labs and some of our friends associated with the Parallel Data Petascale Data Storage Institute, and you see a graph in here which shows the cumulative distribution function, that is the fraction of the files that are smaller than a certain size. And the really interesting thing is right over on the left, which is 2K files, there is between 20% and 80% of the files are less than 2K in size in supercomputer sites where there are tens of millions of files. That's a very, very large number of files that are really tiny. And at 32K, which I still consider to be tiny, it's up to 90% of the files are less than 32K. So even our gigantic machines with a gigantic engine to generate data Which do, by the way, as you can see in the top there, that's a 5-9s representation. There's a really interesting distribution of really large files out there, but there's not very many of them. The vast majority of files are really tiny. All right. So I'm going to finish. What I did was to take some data that we got from public release, and I want to reinforce what Gary said. You want academics to think about your problems, you seduce them. You give them something that they can't get from somebody else. You give them data. You give them something that they know they can get papers out of, and you will get their attention. Right? So trace your system, monitor your system, put your data out there, and make sure they can see it and they understand what it means, and then watch them play. Right? That's a very good strategy. So we got some data. We used that data to construct models predicting the failure rates in future systems, to focus our attention on checkpointing needing to be revisited, as well as, even if we have to rely on the storage solution, the failure rates that we're going to experience in the storage solution side, and the attention we have to put into recovery mechanisms in the storage subsystem side. A lot of hard work to be done in all these things. There are directions that look like they can pay off. We'll have to continuously work on it in the next 10 years for it not to fall off. And there isn't any one single point solution, sorry, Paul, that will make it all go away. No. There is a fast paper. We'll tell you more about some of the techniques I was referring to in parallel reconstruction. All right. I want to do one side message. My one side message is that really data is essential. Yes, we build a computer for cycles most of the time, and the data is incidental. And there's going to be applications where it remains the case that the cycles are really what's important and the data is incidental. But it's going to be an increasing number of applications where the data is what's important and the cycles are incidental. Right? And that's going to be more and more of science. I love this example. NIST had a competition translating Arabic to English, and Google entered it in 2005 with a team that was brand new, wasn't particularly sophisticated in solutions, but they brought brute force. Big computers, a trillion words of English grammar, 200 million words of translated documents, and they did the total optimization of the probability of all pairs of words in the documents, and that result was qualitatively better than anybody else with a longer history of analysis. I use this as my example, that a scientist that wants to do cutting-edge science that doesn't have a big pile of data to test it on and a big computer to test it with is greatly disadvantaged. Right? This is the future, that you will need huge amounts of data, and, yeah, incidentally, if you've got huge amounts of data, you're going to need a computer to process it. That's why we need petascale computers, not because we need the cycles, although there's some applications where you just need the cycles. There's an increasing number of them that are there because of the data and have to do something with the data, and it's the data that matters. So I'm a data bigot. I think we are building computers in the future because of the data that's under them, and we'll care more and more about how we handle that data. All right, I'm done.